This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. What if space isn't silent at all, but alive with signals we just can't see? Today on Cool Science Radio, we're joined by Emma Chapman, an award-winning astrophysicist and Royal Society research fellow, whose new book, The Echoing Universe, reveals how radio waves from the moon to the farthest galaxies are helping scientists unlock the hidden story of our cosmos.
From probing the hostile surface of Venus to searching for the universe's very first stars, Emma Chapman takes us inside the cutting-edge world of radio astronomy, where invisible signals are rewriting what we know about everything from dark matter to the origins of time itself. Emma Chapman, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. Here we are talking on the radio, but our little radio, KPCW here in Park City, Utah, has nothing to do with radio waves, but it is all about electromagnetic radiation. Can you explain what these radio waves are?
Sure. Radio waves are just a different kind of light. So light is a big spectrum, electromagnetic waves, as you just said. The optical light that our eyes have evolved to see is this tiny little narrow rainbow. But actually, there's a whole spectrum, and you'll be familiar with so many. You'll use microwaves to heat your dinner. You'll use infrared light to detect like the thermal signatures of criminals running through fields. And radio waves are the longest wavelength of that spectrum. And what they're really good at, their superpower, is not heating food, it's being able to keep information, to communicate really effectively, traveling long distances without losing any information. And that's why your radio station that you host your program on, it uses radio waves, radio light, to transfer your voices to all of your listeners all over, because radio waves are really good at getting through the atmosphere, getting through clouds, rain, and keeping your lovely voices crystal clear without any kind of loss. Now, radio astronomy is doing all of that, but looking up, and it's communicating not with people around you in your state or your country, but communicating with the universe.
Ah, you found this awe-inspiring. You must have, because you went into it in terms of study and profession. It's a very abstract concept. What was it for you that captured you?
Well, if it comes to the radio part of radio astronomy, I completely had it forced upon me. I'm not going to lie. I managed to get through my entire undergraduate degree in physics without ever encountering radio astronomy. I had no idea what a radio telescope looked like. And then on my first day of my PhD, studying the first stars to exist in our universe, first stars and first black holes, I was told, right, the best way to do that is to use radio telescopes. And I went, that doesn't sound like I'm going to Hawaii like all my colleagues. They're like, no, you're going to the Netherlands. Buy some Wellington boots. And so I had it very much forced upon me. However, it probably took 3 months of hard grind to really kind of to start to understand it a little bit more. There's that just that obstacle, because we've not evolved to see the world in that way. Then I fell in love. Then I realized that these odd little metal contraptions or metal dishes, just like the satellite dishes you might have on your home or the aerials you might have out of your actual radios, they might look quite underwhelming. They might not be in Hawaii, but my God, they're able to look back to the dawn of time and see the signatures of the first stars. And that kind of dichotomy, that like incredible, yeah, that incredible almost hidden talent of these machines just made me fall in love. And now anywhere I visit on holiday, I'm always like, where's the nearest radio telescope? And I will just head there and have my picture taken in front of it, because I just think they're wicked.
Well, I have to say, I love the title of your new book, The Echoing Universe, How Radio Astronomy Helps Us See the Invisible Cosmos. Now, most of us think of astronomy as something, as you mentioned, that you can see. The telescopes, for example, in Hawaii that you mentioned, images, light, and we're seeing a ton of stuff now from, sort of, for example, the James Webb and the Vera C. Rubin. When did you first realize, though, that listening to the universe could be just as powerful or even more so?
I think it was that first day when I kind of thought, well, hang on, how can you use radio waves to look back at the first stars? I thought I would be using something like the James Webb Space Telescope. That's all about the early universe, right? But then I found out that even the mighty Webb can only look so far. And that is because infrared light, which is what Webb sees, is not the best communication tool. It does, otherwise you would be using it. You'd be an infrared cool science radio, cool science infrared station, if you see what I mean. And so being able to travel back 13.8 billion years to gather that information, that light, it had to be radio light. So that was the first time I kind of realized that was an incredibly powerful thing. And then as I started to try and understand the subject a little bit more and basically try and wonder, hang on, how had I not really learned about this much before? I started to dig into all these other subjects and I found out that the first ever exoplanet, a planet outside our solar system, was found using a radio telescope. I found stories of spinning stars that we detected and went a long way to proving Einstein's general relativity using radio telescopes. Everywhere I looked, radio astronomy had been there right at the beginning, very quietly, just getting on with it. And I think the reason we don't know about it so much and the reason I wanted to write this book was because people are afraid of it. People think there's a lot of kind of like mixed metaphor going on with listening to the radio waves and seeing radio light and all this. People are afraid of it because they can't imagine it. But then when I point out that, for example, the images from Hubble, that they are translated for your eyes. They are red, green and blue images taken by their telescope, sometimes even UV, and put all together so that they are palatable for your eyes. And everything you've seen from James Webb Space Telescope is technically invisible to our eyes. It's just that we've done a little paint by numbers trick where we've said, okay, let's say every wavelength of, let's say 20 centimeters is red. Every wavelength of 30 centimeters is blue. And we do a little paint by numbers and then suddenly it's translated and we can see it. Now we do that for all of the astronomy. It's just for sometimes, I think the radio part, people are so familiar with radio as something that we kind of listen to. They don't understand that there is a translation there. There's a translation from me speaking right now into an electric signal, which then goes into a radio wave. And it's the same up there. When we're communicating up there, it's a signal from, let's say, the surface of the moon, and it needs translating. We can do that by painting by numbers, or we can sonify it. We can give it a tone. So we can hear the pings of meteors, for example.
Oh, I like the whole paint by numbers thing. That kind of feeds into my psyche. And by the way, you kind of sometimes you'll be driving across the country and you'll see these huge radio wave dishes, which are just fascinating. I'm always wondering what it is they're listening to. Now, you write in your book that the universe has been broadcasting its stories and secrets all along. And you mentioned the exoplanet example, but I'm wondering, what are some of the other more surprising things that radio waves have revealed that visible light simply can't show us? And just about every sci-fi movie that, sort of starts with this message from beyond, from outer space, all comes through those radio telescopes. The one I'm thinking, of course, is Contact. I'm mm-hmm. sure you're very mm-hmm. familiar with that movie. Are there some really surprising things that radio waves have revealed that visible light just can't pick up right now?
So many in every subject. I'll take an example closer to home and then one a little further. So for example, one wonderful thing that you can do with only radio light and not visible on a scale of space is that we can do this echoing that gives the name of the title of the book. And that means that we can actually send out radio waves, let them bounce off things, listen to the radio light coming back and work out how it's changed. And from that, work out what planetary object or asteroid it's bounced off of. We can't do that with optical light because just put on a torch in a room, it doesn't go very far. Whereas radio light, we can use quite strong dishes to send out this. My most favorite thing that's happened is with Mercury, where we've sent plenty of probes and satellites right up to the surface of Mercury. But the problem was, is that they could never look into the deepest craters because sunlight just couldn't illuminate it. And if you haven't got light, you can't take a photograph. You can't take that light. But what we did with radio light is we sent a whole load of radio waves. It took a few minutes to get there, not the 7 years it takes space probes to get to Mercury or similar. It comes back after a few minutes and it looks like it's bounced off something really shiny. The way in which the light has changed, it's called something called polarization. You can think of it as like the direction that the wave is kind of moving in. It showed that it could only have been water ice, which means that in the deepest craters of Mercury, the closest planet to the sun, a planet that experiences hundreds of Celsius in terms of temperature, has ice. To this day, there is ice on Mercury. That blew my tiny little mind. And I could not wait to tell anybody who would listen. And honestly, it's the kind of thing where I was just running around my family and being like, oh, you wouldn't believe what I found out. You need to be excited as me. And it's, yeah, I don't want people to get through their day without knowing that. And to take an example further from home, we haven't found anything yet, but contact's an excellent example to bring up. There are many, many radio telescopes around the world right now listening to nearby exoplanets and hoping one day to hear a repeating signal. And the reason we can only do that in radio waves is because of this superpower to slip through the atmosphere of not just our planet, but another planet. And without that, their signal would always just get trapped. So it's radio waves that we need to depend on to send a signal to extraterrestrial life or indeed receive one.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're joined by Emma Chapman. She's an award-winning astrophysicist and the author of a new book called The Echoing Universe, talking about radio waves. Emma, let's go back a bit to, you know, you mentioned that whenever you go on vacation and you find a radio telescope, you take a picture of yourself in front of one. And then Scott mentioned, you know, these great discs that you see. If we also want to take a picture of ourselves on vacation in front of one, where do we find them? You know, what do they look like?
Sure. I mean, there's an incredible diversity in what they look like. The kind of traditional large radio telescope will look like a very large dish, like the satellite dish on your house, except let's say 300 feet across kind of thing. And you can find an example in the US, for example, in the West Virginia Green Bank Telescope, and or its equivalent is Jodrell Bank in the UK. There's a few of those dotted around the world. There was, until fairly recently, Arecibo, which was 300 meters across in Puerto Rico. And now there's the same kind of dish, but in China, which is now half a kilometer in diameter. Those are the big ones that, like Scott said, when you're driving, you almost, as I once did, put your car into a ditch because you like just start looking up at the sky and bending your steering wheel. But actually, a radio telescope, depending on what it's looking for, the ones I use to look for the first stars aren't dishes at all. They're what we call bow tie antennas, and they're very low to the floor. They're only, let's say, half a meter, and they just look like metal bow ties slotted together, like something you get from IKEA or something, and like just slotted on the ground. But what we could do is we can actually plug in, let's say, 1,300 of them is what we've got in the Netherlands. Or we're building one in the Western Australian desert, which looks like a big Christmas tree. And we're going to put 130,000 of those linked together. So with radio telescopes, you have to often know what you're looking for. So do Google it. Or in the back of the book, I've actually put a tourist's guide and you can maybe just see, but that's a very small number of the kind that are around. But you email these places. I was in Berkeley and I just noticed a dish on the horizon and I did a bit of Googling, emailed them, and it turns out that it was tracking missions to the moon for NASA. And I was like, can I come and have a look, please? And they were absolutely overjoyed to show me. And yeah, I also rented a car and drove 3.5 hours north and went to the Allen Telescope Array, which is about 42 of these smaller dishes, and they're looking for extraterrestrial life. So it's fascinating what all of these things can be doing, just silently staring at the sky.
Very interesting and kind of enlightening, because I always imagine that these radio telescopes were sort of these huge behemoth dishes, like the one that kind of occurs in the James Bond movie where they're fighting on the big dish and, you know, it's moving and all that stuff. That was
that's
Arecibo. Right. But here on Cool Science Radio, we seem to be a little bit obsessed with dark matter and dark energy and how it makes up a lot of the universe. But we can barely detect that. So how does radio astronomy help us get a handle on things we essentially can't see or touch, like dark matter?
It's able to just look at the universe in a complementary way. Different wavelengths of light probe the same cosmological entities, but with kind of the different physics processes happening. So an example is that James Webb Space Telescope is really good at tracing hot gas and stellar nurseries, whereas radio light is much better at looking at cold gas. Now, what that means is that if we look at a galaxy, the way we've detected dark matter so far, not directly, but we've been able to measure how quickly stars are orbiting around the center of a galaxy. And as you go out, these stars should slow down if it's just stars in this galaxy. But what we found is that they don't. And the only way you can make that happen is if there's this mysterious dark matter pervading the whole of the galaxy. But that method only works until the last star. Now, if you look at the same galaxy, but in radio light, suddenly you're able to trace the scaffolding of gas upon which all those stars hang and are made of, and you're able to go out up to three times further than those stars. So you're able to trace the distribution of dark matter way out, much, much further out, and get a better handle on its distribution, for example. And it's able to do that really fast. So the power of these radio telescopes is that they're able to survey the sky, sometimes at quite low resolution when you're at 13 billion year light year distances, but it's able to get this big picture of dark matter and indeed dark energy. Whereas a lot of the other complementary methods are able to focus in really well and get like the small scale details right. But to really understand what's going on in a wider universe, you need a bigger survey. You need a bigger picture. And that's what radio waves give.
In addition to dark matter, dark energy detection, I also understand that radio astronomy has played a huge role in confirming gravitational waves, ripples in space-time itself. Can you maybe help our listeners picture what that actually means? And why is it such a landmark moment for astrophysics?
Sure, I could. This is a whole podcast radio thing on its own, to be honest.
But we could have you back.
Please, anytime. I can talk about spinning stars a lot. But there's this kind of star called a neutron star. And that's a star that's come to the end of its life and collapsed to such a high density that all of its atoms have been turned into neutrons. It's really dense, really compact. And usually it's spinning very, very fast. Now, it's cooled down, so it's invisible in the optical. But in radio light, big beams of radio light are coming out of this star. And if it's at the right orientation, then these beams sweep over Earth every time it rotates, just like a lighthouse. Now, the timing of that is as accurate as an atomic clock that we might make in a laboratory on Earth. Now, what we can do is Einstein's general relativity predicts precisely how much gravitational wave radiation. So as anything moves in Einstein space-time, it should give off little ripples, just as if it's a boat going through a lake. And it works out exactly how much energy those ripples take away and how much that object that's spinning should slow down. So we look at these rotating neutron stars and we measure by how much they slow down over decades. And sure enough, it matches Einstein's general relativity precisely. Again, you can only do that with radio waves because they're invisible, these stars at every other wavelength. And radio telescopes, because they're on Earth most of the time, they last for 50, 60, 70 years. And that's the kind of length of observation you need to do this kind of work.
This is just a fascinating world. And you know what, Emma, you're a really good person to turn lay people on to this. So thank you. And speaking of lay people, going back to the film Contact and how they were able to pick up these eerie sounds and then, you know, they brought in the linguist and then they figured out the language. And how can we as lay people ever hear/see these radio waves?
Absolutely. Some amateur astronomical societies will have a little radio wing where people will experiment. Unfortunately, you can't see what's behind me at the minute, but I have a little tiny home antenna. It looks like maybe the size of a computer monitor, and it's a diamond of copper wire hung over two wooden cross sticks. What that does is it picks up solar radiation, solar waves, solar flares coming through our atmosphere. And so you can hook it up to a computer and you can see the kind of lines. You can Google meteor pings or meteor beacon, and you can put some headphones on, you can close your eyes, and somewhere they will be recording incoming pieces of asteroids, so meteorites, coming through the atmosphere, lighting up the atmosphere, giving out radio waves. And you can literally just sit back and listen to ping, 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 ping. And you could do that in a day. And that is you sitting there. Do this with your kid. Tell them they are listening to shooting stars in the day. And that's a lot of fun.
There are times, are there not, that we here on Earth can be affected by radio waves that are in some sort of radio wave storm, or I don't know what you would call it. I'm thinking of a solar storm, but can you explain that?
Sure. If I haven't convinced you that this is an interesting topic because it's just of the awe of it, I should be able to convince you on the fact that it does threaten human existence sometimes. Because what happens in a solar storm is the sun throws off loads and loads of particles that travel towards us, and it also throws off lots and lots of radio light. So when it has a tantrum, it throws off this radio light. Now, when all of those particles and that radio light reaches Earth, it basically heats the atmosphere ever so slightly. It causes a lot of radio interference, which means radio stations will drop out. And even worse, any satellites that haven't been able to kind of adjust their trajectories according to this can fall. And this has been happening to Starlink satellites. So you can find news things of this. So the solar flares comes in, they will lose several satellites and they will just crash to Earth. Not only that, but you can have electrical grids overloaded. Now, this is mostly due to the particles I spoke of that are thrown off the surface of the sun. The radio waves don't cause as much kind of physical damage, but what they do is they act as a bit of a warning system, which is vital. And we haven't got this all pinned down yet, but if we can learn better how to translate these incoming radio waves and be like, oh, this means that this kind of big solar load of particles is coming, quick, shut down the grid, like the electric grid, so it doesn't overload, that can help save a huge amount of infrastructure. And indeed, that is what we do at the minute. A huge amount of work goes into shutting down electricity grids at certain times when solar waves are coming through.
Wow. So they are detectable. We just have to know how to detect them. And then with so many more satellites being launched and so much space junk floating around up there, and this is going to become a much bigger topic, won't it? I mean, especially when some of this junk is falling to Earth.
For sure. Absolutely. It's already a topic which surprises. I think the only reason it's not in the news more is because nobody has so far, thankfully, been killed. But honestly, the number of satellites that they're putting up there and the number that are able to fall down in something that we simply can't control, like a solar flare. Yeah, somebody is going to get hurt. What's interesting is that the legal side of this is really not caught up. So I believe I'm right in what I'm saying, but to the best to my knowledge, that the law is still that if a satellite falls on your house, it's not actually the maker of the satellite liable. It's actually the government where that company is kind of based. So it's the government that is not that. So the companies can pretty much get away with it at the minute, to the best of my knowledge. So it's a bit of an interesting time. And I give a lot of talks to children about what they should do with their careers and their future lives. And I say, you know, like, if you've got an interest in space or anything like that, you don't have to become an astronomer. You could become a space lawyer, because we really need you right now.
Wow.
To help protect the skies, protect our houses for a start, but also protect our right as humanity to have a shared sky that we can look up to and escape to and enjoy without seeing it just ripped apart by streaks of light of satellites. There is a middle ground. These satellites are really important in so many ways for developing countries and giving them Wi-Fi. Do we need a million of them from several different companies? No. No, we do not.
I'm glad.
Sorry, I just get on a bit of a rant when anybody asks me about that. I have to bring it back, Emma.
It's a very pertinent rant, and it's something that ties together this, what was formerly sort of a fringe area of study, right, into our everyday lives, is talking about these satellites that we're becoming increasingly dependent upon, and yet we need to know the reality. Emma Chapman, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. In the book, The Echoing Universe. And wow, do you talk about it in such a way that it is, a person can grasp it.
Thank you. That's very kind. I do it for myself because that's how I understand things, breaking them down. Otherwise, I just can't. But it's been a pleasure talking to you. So thank you so much.